All right, thank you, guys. I've encouraged you. Woo. That's a really big step. Okay, no. I'd like to encourage you to get involved. Obviously, one of the things, the uniquenesses of St. Louis is the division between county and city. And not only financially, and in lots of other ways, including racially. And we want to fight back against that division because it's difficult. So I just encourage you to maybe get involved if you can. I want to give you a heads up. A little later in our service, we're going to take communion together. Jesus said when he served communion, he served the wine and the bread to his disciples. He said, "Do this in remembrance of me." They didn't really exactly know what he was talking about. They didn't know for sure that that night he would be arrested and the next day he would be executed. But he said, "Do this in remembrance of me because it represents my body that's going to be broken for you. It represents my blood that's going to be shed for your sin. And so do this in remembrance for me." And he says, "I will not do this again with you until I do it in heaven with you again at the wedding supper of the Lamb." And so we do this waiting, anticipating of doing this with Christ again in a heavenly sense, in a heavenly place. So we're going to observe it today. And it really, the scriptures tell us that the people that participate in this, because here at Quest, we say that we want to be all about people who are skeptics and inquirers and already convinced. And so if you're here this morning as a skeptic or an inquirer, you're not really sure you believe this yet, you're just kind of hanging out with it, kind of wrestling with it, talking with people about it, trying to evaluate whether you buy into this, probably communion is not a place where you'd come, because it's really someone saying, "Hey, I believe that this really is." Just like that song said, "I believe in God the Father. I believe in Christ the Son. I believe in the resurrection. I believe what he did for me, and I've incorporated it in my own life." And so if you're already convinced, this is a place for you. If you're a skeptic or an inquirer, this is a place for you, but probably communion wouldn't be appropriate. There's one other group of people that scriptures tell us that's not appropriate for to take communion, is if you are a believer, but you're out of fellowship with him, you know clearly in your head and heart, "I am at odds with God and I am not willing to deal with it right now. I am going to stay there. I'm mad at him, and or I'm rebellious and I'm going to be there." It says that don't do this because it's really denying what he did for us. And so if you're in that place, which we have all been, right? Of course, we've been there. Maybe today is a day you say, "Okay, I'm not going to participate because my heart can't really be in the same place." Now, to participate doesn't mean you have to be sinless, okay? It just means that you have to go, "Okay, I'm a total sinner, and I'm giving it to Christ. I'm confessing it as reality, and here it is. And God, I know this is why you, Christ, this is why you died for me. This was very sin in my life. And so I come and participate because of out of a humility of his forgiveness." So that's kind of what we're going to do in a little while for communion. So I want to continue as we worship together. I want to focus on some things we've been talking about for the last several weeks. But we've been talking about life. And it's really a kind of a fundamental question, isn't it? What is life all about? Why do I exist? Where is it going? What am I doing? How do I connect with it? And then we've also been talking about love. We've been trying to ask the question here at Quest for this season of our church is, what does it look like to love, really? And I would suggest to you, if we take that seriously, and we've seen this happening, God is going to say, "Okay, I'll teach you, I'll show you." But it just quietly, he might say, "But it may not feel great, because I'm going to challenge you at the depths of who you are." I'll share in a few weeks about some of the places where God has been really pressing in my heart and revealing in my heart some things where I didn't love very well. It's probably not surprising, right? Of course. But it's just things he's doing. But we're trying to combine those to say, okay, what's our love life look like? Well, we're going to talk about that in a while down the road several months from now. But today, in this season, we want to talk about what does it mean to love life, to really love life. And so usually, traditionally, in the United States, we have this time on January 15th, where we call it Sanctity of Life Sunday. It typically would focus on the unborn. But what we decided to do in all of January is call it a Sanctity of Life Month and focus on the issues of the sanctity of life. Because when we say that we believe in God the Father, when we believe in God the Son, when we believe in the resurrection, one of the things that we actually really say too is that we believe in the sanctity of life, the importance of life itself, all life that he created. And so the very first week in this series, we talked about the foundation of this and being made in the image of God, okay? And then last week, we talked about the sanctity of the infirm, the disabled, in a culture that is beginning to shove them farther and farther and farther away, that is such a violation. And when we violate people, we violate God, and we violate each other. And it's unacceptable. It's not right. And so the sanctity of the infirm. And now, next week, we're going to talk about the sanctity of the unborn or the children. Frankly, those who are in the dawn of life, we're going to talk about them. But today, I want to talk about the sanctity of the elderly. And I'm not doing that because I'm getting there closer all the time. Now, I've talked to a bunch of people, and I've asked them, well, how would you define elderly? And everyone I've talked to, whether they're 20 or 90, say, I don't know, but it's someone older than me, you know? It's just someone a little bit older than me. And I totally get that, because that's the way I feel too. But I found this quote. We've used it every week, and I'm going to use it again. I'll probably continue to use it, by Hubert Humphrey, the former senator and vice president. And he said this: the moral test of government is how that government treats those who are in the dawn of life, the children, those who are in the twilight of life, the elderly, and those who are in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped. And I think he's right. These are biblical thoughts. That's a biblical way of seeing things. That is the moral test of government, but not only the moral test of government, but the moral test of our society. Because our government simply is made up of people that we've elected, and they reflect our society. That's us. And so it's really a moral test of our society and how we treat these people. And not only that, but maybe more importantly, it's the moral test of the church. And I think that that's probably true in this day and age, as much as many other things, that it's going to be the moral test of the church in the years to come. How will we treat these people? So this morning, I want to focus on those who are in the twilight of life, the elderly. How do we treat them? What are they all about? So it's God's design. And what's his design for life and for valuing human life? So as in God's design, we started in this place in Genesis chapter 1, verses 27. It says, so God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. That God created us in his image. Like nothing else in the entire world. No tree, no dog, no deer, no flower. Nothing was made in the image of God except for mankind. Now, do I like trees? I do. Do I like dogs? I do. Do I like flowers? Absolutely. Do I love the deer that run through this property? Sometimes when you're out here and see them, I love them. My wife hates them. She doesn't really like deer. They eat her flowers. And they eat all the hosta, and they eat everything. And I secretly am okay with it. But I don't say it at home. So I don't say that at home. So don't tell her I said this, okay? But God created mankind in his image. Wow. Then last week, we looked at Exodus chapter 4, when it said this, and God said to him, this disabled person, he says, this is Moses who's saying, hey, I don't speak very well. And God says to him, okay, who cares? Who has made man's mouth? Who has made him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I? He's saying, I can use this in your life, and I can use this to glorify me. So, Here are kind of the big ideas since we've started. First of all, the Imago Dei, that's Latin for the image of God, defines who we are. That we are made in the image of God, it defines who we are. Nothing else defines us. Nothing you do, your job does not really actually define you. You're bigger than that, you're more important than that. What your kids do or don't do doesn't define you, because eventually they get their free will and they do all sorts of strange things. And it doesn't define us as a person. We are defined by the fact that we were made in the image of God, period. That defines us. Secondly, us is expressed uniquely. The first week we talked about uniquely is male and female. And we live in a culture that's struggling with figuring that out and what that means, to be made as a man and a woman. But when we demean that, we demean God. We demean all sorts of things. There is a beauty to being a guy. There is an awesomeness to being a woman. And that we both are equal and yet incredibly different. Wow, it's fabulous. And next, that in God's permissive will, we also find his ultimate will of using all things for his glory, even our disabilities. No one has a lack of value. So the reality is this, is that we say that mankind is a broken glory. He is a broken glory. He is a glorious wreck, if you will. That yes, we're broken, we're messed up, we're screwballs, we're knuckleheads, we're sinful. But it is a glory to it because of what God made us in his image. And so this week I want to talk about a little bit about the sanctity of the elderly in this time. Psalm 71, verse 9, I think is kind of a big idea here for us to start with, okay? It says, "Do not cast me off in the time of old age. Forsake me not when my strength is spent." Boy, we live in a culture where we have cast them off. We have kind of pushed them to the edges of society and put them where we cannot see them. And he says, don't cast me off in old age. I have a lot to offer at this point still when I'm older. And in fact, I want to go back to something I've done with you before, but I want to go back because it's really helped me and I think it's helped others. Let's put this little graph up here. Here's the first point is getting older can be beautiful. It's a thing of beauty. Now, here's the deal. So I've kind of broken life here into these four sections, you know, if you will. The first section from 1 to 20 is all about identity. That's the key event of a person's life between 1 and 20 is figuring out who they are. That's why the sexual revolution has really been kind of played havoc with people figuring out who in the world they are. But it's a natural process of figuring out who you are between 1 and 20. You can learn math, you can learn history, and you need to learn those. So if you're here in high school or junior high, you need to learn those things. You need to listen to your language arts teacher. So that lady is important. That's my wife. And so... I mean, these two people are really important, okay? But the key thing, parents, is them learning who they are as a person. And let's face it, it's not easy. It is quite a challenge. In this culture, any culture, it's a challenge to figure out who you are as a person. But your identity, and remember, our identity is caught up in the fact that we're made in the image of God. And so here's this beautiful young person, made in the image of God, that needs help in learning who they are as a person. That's the key event of a person between 1 and 20. These ages are rough, right? But that's about right. Second, from 20 to 40, it's all about learn and grow. Life is all about learning and growing. We shouldn't be too anxious to get on and have that permanent job that does everything for us forever and a day. But the fact that we're going to learn and we're going to grow, right? So a lot of people get married somewhere in that area. That's a learning and growing experience, just so you know. I mean, you're going to learn and grow like you've never learned and grown before, right? And then you're going to have kids, and then it's going to be multiplied, this learning and growing process. And you get a job, and you try to figure it out, and then you figure out what's the best kind of place for you, and you get a promotion, and then you move on, and it's just an incredible amount of learning and growing. And it's really an important part of life. So that's from 20 to 40. Then from 40 to 60 is all about, if you've done a good job learning your identity and you've done a good job of learning and growing, you enter into this time of tremendous influence. Now, it's not that you don't have influence before that. Of course you do. But there's this amazing maturity that comes with you. I was looking through the list of presidents and when they became president. The vast majority of the presidents of the United States have become president during this time, 40 to 60. There's some a little older. There's no one's been younger than that. But there's this amazing time of influence because you've learned and you've grown, you know who you are, you're secure in who you are, and you can lead. You can have influence. And I think it's an incredible idea. So you wield influence during this time of your life. And then comes this time from 60 to whatever, all right, the question mark, a time of wisdom. Because if you know who you are, and you've learned, and you've grown, and you've wielded influence, you've probably made a variety of mistakes and experiences, and you come to this place of having wisdom. It's incredible, right? This is a time of the elderly, in a sense, of really wielding wisdom. And we take those people, and we ship them off, and we lose all that wisdom that they have to offer. In fact, look at this. So the wisdom, people in the area of wisdom need to give back to the people who have influence, right? Of course they do. I've just been reading a book called Five Presidents by Clint Hill. He was a Secret Service agent under five different presidents. And at one time, I just read the section a couple of nights ago, that Lyndon Johnson was facing some issues that he didn't know what to do. And in fact, he was going to have gallbladder surgery. This seems silly that he needed advice, but he didn't know what to do, if he should tell the public or not. And so he had a secret rendezvous with President Eisenhower, former President Eisenhower. And he said, "What do you think I should do?" And he said, "Tell the people. Be honest about it. It's not a big deal. If you don't be honest, they'll wonder what you're up to." So that afternoon, he called a press conference and said, "Hey, I'm going to have gallbladder surgery. Everything's going to be cool." And everybody went, "Super, great. Psh, get on with it." You know. And but he needed wisdom from President Eisenhower. And look at this. In 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 6, this is where Rehoboam. Rehoboam is the son of Solomon. Solomon had been the king. He gives over the kingdom to Rehoboam. And Rehoboam now takes over, and he needs some advice. And look at this. It says, there were some older men who had helped Solomon make decisions when he was alive. And so King Rehoboam asked these men what he should do. And he said, how do you think I should answer the people? It was really wise. Now, unfortunately, when he went to these older men, Rehoboam asked them, because there were heavy taxes in Israel at that time, really heavy taxes. And so all of Rehoboam's advisors, which were guys his age, said, "You need to raise the taxes. You need to make it more burdensome. If they think they have a whip right now, you need to give them a scorpion," is what it says. "You need to really nail them." And so he went to these older guys and he said, "What do you think I should do?" And they said, no, you're going to kill them if you raise the taxes. You're going to cause all sorts of problems. You need to lower the taxes." Now, I'm not making political comments today, okay? That's not what I'm saying. He said, "You need to lower it because the people are under an incredible burden." And so he went away and he thought about it. And he disagreed with these older men's advice. And so he raised the taxes. He made scorpions on them. And there was an incredible civil war. Jeroboam came back and led the 10 northern tribes in a civil war against the lower tribes, Judah and Benjamin. And it created this incredible division among the people of God. And he divided them. Eventually, those 10 tribes were taken over by Assyria and scattered to the winds. And we have never been able to identify them ever since. This is one of the tragedies of all of life, historically, is what happened because Rehoboam did not listen to these older men. And he did not take their advice. You see, the wisdom that comes back to those influencers is huge. It's incredibly important. Now, you know, not only to the influence, but the wisdom that those people have to give to those who are learning and growing. They have so much to offer. They've been down that road. They've run that lap. They've been there before. I know we think they don't get it, but guess what? They actually do. They actually understand it. Look at this. In Psalm 71, verses 18 and 19. This is really a beautiful, beautiful passage. It says, "Now that I am old and my hair is gray, or I have less hair than ever before." He missed that part. "But don't leave me, God." Hey, I think we all feel that. We feel that at any age. But especially sometimes when you're older, you begin to wonder, "God, where are you?" But he says this, he goes on and he says, "God, don't leave me, because I must tell the next generation about your power and your greatness." I want to tell that next generation how amazing you are. That's like evangelism, right? I mean, that's like cool. That is like teaching. That's like investing. That's like telling people, "Let me tell you about my life and what God has done and how incredibly beautiful he is, how incredibly powerful he is, how incredibly great God is." And it comes with some substance because of where they've been and what they've done. Wow. "God, your goodness reaches far above the skies, and you have done wonderful things. God, there is no one like you. And I want to tell the generations below me. I want to tell those who are learning and growing all about you. I want to draw them close to me. I want to put my arms around them. I want to speak to them kindly, and I want to tell them about how awesome God is." But if you haven't, don't know who you are, and you haven't learned and grown, and you never wielded influence, you will not have wisdom to give back to these other generations. And so, this generation wants to tell those learners and growers, God is awesome. Wow, that's incredible, isn't it? Well, not only that, not only do the wisdom people give back to the influencers and give back to those who learn and grow, but they also give back to those who have identity or trying to figure out who they are, right? Of course. So here in Proverbs 13 and Proverbs 19, look at this. It says, a wise son hears his father's instruction. You see, there's this wisdom of young people. If they will embrace what they are taught, that it helps in life. We live in a time where really subtly the younger generation is told, do not listen, they don't get it, they don't matter, they don't understand. And in fact, what they'll tell you is probably not what you want to hear, therefore do not listen. And what that sends them is down a very foolish road. And at the end of that foolish road is a place of destruction, rather than a really wise road, that the end of that is good things. Wow, it says, why a wise son hears his father's instruction. Wow. Look at this in Proverbs 19. Listen to advice and accept instruction that you may gain wisdom in the future. And that's what these people of wisdom have to give to those who are trying to figure out who they are. Wow, look at this. In fact, look at one of my favorites, because I just entered into this world, Proverbs 17:6. Grandchildren are the crown of the aged. You know, just 5 months ago, September 4th, Diane and I became grandparents of little Autumn. We looked at her pictures, we talked to her, we see her on FaceTime. Wow, it's incredible. And she hasn't talked back once, not once to us. And the glory of children is their fathers. You know, I found it interesting that these two lines were put together in this proverb because of the kind of the nuclear family that used to be much tighter, grandparents and parents all interacting with this younger generation. You know, and I just want to say, and I haven't really gotten there yet, but there is a beauty about being a grandparent. It's always been said that the beauty of being a grandparent is, or the reward, the grandchildren are the reward for having not killed your children. And I think there's some truth to that. But the reality is, there is a role that a grandparent plays in a kid's life, or can play in a kid's life, that is like none other. So you don't have to be the disciplinarian quite so much. The parents get to do that. You get to just enter in and just kind of love and connect and guide. How many of you had a grandparent that played a profoundly important role in your life? How many people? Look at that. You guys, that's amazing, isn't it? Yeah. Now, I didn't really have that. And I would say one of the poverties of my life is the fact that my grandfather on my dad's side, who died when my dad was a teenager as a result of being gassed in the trenches of northern France during World War I, I never got to meet him. It's one of the sad pieces of my life. I think I would have really liked him. I think I would have really liked him. I didn't get that. And my other grandfather was pretty distant. And so I didn't really get that piece so much. But there is a beauty to being a grandparent, because what you bring is great wisdom with great connection to these kids' lives. And they need it. They need it. Okay. I think getting older is beautiful. Look at this, Benjamin Franklin. He's not someone we quote a ton in church, but he said this one time, and I love this. He says, those who love deeply never grow old. They may die of old age, but they die young. Isn't that what we're talking about? It's taking this wisdom and bringing it back to every generation and doing it with a deep, deep, deep love, so that we never grow old. People who love never grow old. That's awesome, isn't it? It's amazing. Look at this in Isaiah chapter 46. Even to your old age and gray hairs, I am he. And here's the point. Getting older is not for sissies. You know, you've heard that said, but it's true. Getting older is hard, right? It is hard. I mean, you start to lose things. You know, you lose your hair, you know, You lose your eyesight a little bit. You lose your hearing a little bit. Sometimes you lose independence. I'm talking to my mom. She's 92. She's thinking, I think I need to stop driving. I'm thinking, I think you do too. you know, but really, frankly, she's still pretty good at it. She's pretty amazing. She's a tough gal. But you begin to lose your independence. She's lost her home. She's lost her husband. My dad died 6 years ago, 7 years ago. You begin to lose things. It's hard. It is really hard. Sometimes you begin to lose your memory. Sometimes you begin to lose all sorts of things. That loss process, I was talking to an older woman not too long ago, and she was telling me, I've lost my husband, I've lost my home, I've lost so much, my independence, my freedom, and I've lost my church. Because she felt like her church had moved on, and it was a place that she no longer recognized and felt isolated from. That's really tragic. It really hit me. And I thought, golly, we want this to be a church that's intergenerational, where we can value every person, and people don't have to totally lose their church. But here in Isaiah, I think God knew this. Isaiah wrote this, even to your old age, into your old age and your gray hairs, I am he. Even when we're old, God is still God. I am he who will sustain you. I have made you and I will carry you. I will sustain you and I will rescue you. That God is aware and knows and enters in to that portion of our lives. Wow. Here's one of maybe in that whole idea. Point number three I'd like to make is that getting older should be honored. Okay? So in Leviticus 19, it says this, rise, and I love this. You guys, this is powerful. I just want you to think about this, okay? Rise in the presence of the aged and honor the elderly face to face. Honor your God, I am the Lord. Wow, you guys think about that for a second. He says this commandment, the whole scriptures speak of the value of the elderly. Every piece of it does. And here it says, rise in the presence of the aged. When they enter the room, stand up. And I try to teach, you know, our young people, hey, when they come in, stand up and walk over to them face to face and say hello, good morning. Be bold, be respectful, be honest, be engaging, because these people have been around the block. They've done a lot. Rise up in the presence of the aged and honor the elderly face to face. Wow. What if we were a culture like that? A lot of other cultures are. The Asian cultures, on the most part, are very much like that. To totally honor the elderly. Wow, it's incredible. I think that's a Christian thing that we ought to do. Now, it seems to me that getting older should be, we should honor that. But probably the best way to do that is by way of example. So this morning, I have an example I'd like to share with you. But I'd like to start, as you three guys come on up, can you play that first clip for us?
Oh, you know, devil gets on me all the time. Saying, you know, why you go to church? You can't hear what they're saying. And if you really see me, I'd laugh in his face, because I ain't about to quit going to church, because even though I don't hear him, I like fellowship with other Christians.
Yeah.
That's why I like to go to these guys at lunch, you know, breakfast, because they're real good Christian people.
Mm-hmm. All right. You guys, sit over here. Is Tim here? Okay. So you guys, I want to introduce you. What's going on here? This guy is a guy named Bob Hale. His wife has passed away. His name is Helen. They call him Breakfast Bob because they love him that way. Oddly enough, strangely enough, he died last Sunday. He passed away. But there's this group of guys who get together, they still get together, but they've been meeting at Denny's. I think you were part of the original group.
I was. It was at least 15 years ago. We made a decision after going through men's fraternity at First Free. There were three of us that didn't want to stop meeting together and having fellowship. So it was Bud Blossfield, Millard McDonald, and myself, and we went to Denny's. It was central for us then, and been meeting there every Thursday morning at 6 a.m. for a lot of years.
And I think they eventually called it, kiddingly, Christian men behaving badly. I'm not totally sure. That was when Bud was there.
Thanks for that, Kevin. Yeah, we really appreciate that. I wasn't going to say that, but thank you for calling us out.
And I always called it men going through serious garbage. It was really hard. But along the way, then, these guys joined. How did that happen?
Well, for me, I actually joined that group before I was a believer. It's going to probably be about 8 years ago, I'd say, that I joined that group. Same time I was counseling with NAP and happened to meet Bud, and I couldn't get out of the hug, so I had to go. But that's when I joined that group, and it was made a big difference in my life, as well as just all the people, I guess, Mike and I were talking this morning, that have come through there, come through that table, that we've met, people that are part of that today, that really it was just out of sharing the word and dealing with stuff. I meant every week we'd kind of go through, you know, somebody might be dealing with something more, and we might spend the whole breakfast talking about it, or we might just spend the whole breakfast celebrating something fun, but they were always there.
That's cool. And Tim, when did you start?
That was probably 2002 or something in that time frame. I had some free time because I was out of a job and looking for a job, and it was just fellowship and, again, coming together with folks to, just to be with a group of men and who understood and who had problems themselves and would help.
Yeah, okay. And then somewhere along the line, Bob, can you tell, how'd that happen? How did he become a part of your group?
Well, just to add to context, it was interesting, and I just found this out at his wake, that something happened that I didn't know about. And we'd been there so long. Our current waitress is fairly young, but when we began there, it was her grandmother that waited on us. So we've been there a long time, right? However, we've gotten to know the waitresses at that restaurant, and they understand who we are, and just by the example that I guess we set, Bob came in just over 4 years ago to the restaurant, and he was in another booth, and we bought his lunch or his breakfast. And what I didn't know was that the waitresses knew him better than we did, because he came in there a couple days a week. And even though we told them not to tell him that we had done that, we just wanted to do it as a nice gesture. The next time he came in, they told him, and then they encouraged him to come sit with us or to be with us at our table, right? So they were working in that way, and we didn't know it, right? But he came back in the next week and brought memorabilia, some stuff from World War II, newspaper clippings, and just other things that he thought we might like. But he approached the table not in a boisterous or a way to show off. He was very timid about it. He was really an interesting guy, and he was so just a really sweet personality. He goes, I don't know if you guys would be interested in this at all or if you'd even like that, but we immediately welcomed him to the table, and then we asked him to pray with us, right? And that's when the connection really began. And after he prayed with us, then he sat with us at breakfast every week from there on.
For the last 4 years.
For the last 4 years and about 3 months, and it just happened to be 30 days. When he joined us, it was about 30 days after his wife had passed, and they had been married for 67 years.
And wow. Here's a picture of Bob and Helen.
Yeah. Wow. And, he missed her so much. He must have told us dozens of times the same story about how it was so perfect the way God took her. She had an aneurysm. They knew she wouldn't live real long, but they were together in the assisted care living home, and he just repeated the story almost verbatim dozens of times, and he'd say, have I told you this yet? But he did, right? He just enjoyed saying it because he enjoyed the memory of Helen and how she just looked up at him in his arms and said, I love you, closed her eyes, and passed. And he said, I knew immediately she was gone, but he knew where she was. I mean, he knew where she went. And that's the thing we got to know about Bob. Our initial impression about Bob was we were in awe because of his World War II hat. We saw him as a World War II veteran. We saw him possibly as a guy with really great stories or really great history, and that we ought to honor that. But the more we got to know Bob, we really came to be in awe of him for his faith and how he had just given everything up. He was very humble, always referred to the Lord as the reason for things and that things happened. And he'd always wonder out loud, I don't know, I don't know why he left me here when he took Helen. Why didn't he take me? Well, I think these guys and all of us could give him at least a dozen reasons.
We used to always kid him when he would say it almost every week as he left. He's like, boy, I want to go be with Helen, but for some reason the good Lord's making me stay here. I don't know what it is I'm still supposed to do. And we would kiddingly say, you still have some things to teach us because we're not there yet. But earlier Luke was talking about in the palm of God, that's how Bob lived his entire life. I think, you know, I've heard all the stories from probably 12 years old. He was working on the farm behind a plow team, horses doing the farming. He wanted to go to high school then, but he had to work the farm. He couldn't. And all the way through his life, through World War II, through being flying in a bomber over France and Germany, he would talk about what it was like in there, what, and how he got through it. And it was all, he would sing hymns while he was in the bomber with people shooting at him. He'd be singing hymns is what he would be doing. And just he shared that all the way through his life, through the loss of a child, 12-year-old who got cancer. And he talks about when they lost Billy, that he and his wife were there with Billy at the age of 14 then, after 32 weeks in the hospital. And the same way, how they were at peace when he went. He would talk about praying, that they prayed all the time, and he would say, well, some of the prayers aren't answered because they're not supposed to be. And he only found the good in people. There might be things he disliked. He'd share he disliked them, politics being some things that would come up. But he would then turn to the good in people. Everybody had good. And he wouldn't focus on any of the bad.
Wow. Yeah, and it wasn't just the Denny's group that he was part of. He went to Steak and Shake whenever it was Kids Eat Free. I forget which day it is. But he'd go there just to see the kids and interact with them. The grocery store that he went to, they all knew him there. Mike went, he lost his cane once, and Mike went to help look a little bit. I think you said that everybody at the store knew him.
Yeah, immediately after, I walked up to the customer service counter and I said a friend of mine lost his cane, and they went, oh, I know. They immediately identified with the situation, the issue, and gave a really heartfelt, you know, we're really sorry that happened. We're looking for it, and we will let you know just as soon as we come across that. But everywhere Bob went, people just loved him. And I don't think he tried to inspire that. They just loved him for who he was. He was such at peace with his faith and the place he was in his life, and just around other people. I took him to a doctor's appointment one time. You'd have thought I brought a celebrity, Elvis, or someone. Walked in there, and everybody knew Bob. Bob's here, you know, kind of thing. It was really, really very cool. He's
You guys took him to a Cardinals game.
We did.
Had a great time. He laughed. He met Fred Bird. In fact, Fred Bird got to know him very well.
So. It's interesting to talk about the Cardinals game. Bob would talk about baseball sometimes, and we met at 6. Bob was always there by 5 because he did not want to miss anything. So he would generally be there by 5, always, the waitresses said. But he was talking about he couldn't stay up late enough to hear the end of the game. It was one of the extra innings. So we talked about the game, and I said, Bob, when's the last game you were at? And he rattled off the date, he rattled off who they played, and it was in Sportsman's Park. And so that's what gave us the inspiration to take him to the game, and it was such a pleasure. And I know one thing we haven't talked about here, all of our wives very much were also, you know, in Bob's life. They were there, you know, for different events. They were there at the hospital. Bob's actually come to Quest with us before, too. He did attend while we were still at Crestview, and he would always talk about that day as well.
That's cool.
And it was his inner love for Jesus. I mean, Bob couldn't communicate that well. I don't know how long it was, but Bob could not understand consonants. He could get a hearing aid, but it didn't do him any good just to amplify it. He couldn't hear consonants. So as you were talking to him, he had to look at you, and he had to see the context of the sentence to understand what you were saying. So he did all of this with that kind of you know, just the inability to understand quite well. So,
I have a theory about that. I'll just share something that's on my heart. You know, Bob lost, he didn't lose his hearing. He could hear perfectly well, but he couldn't interpret. When a word had too many consonants, his brain just didn't figure it. So he's a little bit difficult to talk to. And when there were three or four of us at breakfast, he would sit there very quiet. Or he would engage the one of us that was closest to him, right? But I think the encouragement was to listen to Bob. Because all you needed to do, it wasn't what we had to say to Bob that was of value. It was what Bob had to say to us that was of value. And I really came to know and appreciate that. And many times I would be the first one there, and it was my Bob time. I just looked so forward to it every single week. I'm thinking to myself, why? But Thursday was the day, and I just really enjoyed it. And all I would have to do is sit down at the table and look at him and say, hi, Bob, how are you? And he would just start to talk. And he talked and talked. And what I found out also at the wake from his nephew was Bob was never like that. Bob was quiet, especially when Helen was around. He didn't talk very much at all. He was very shy and introverted, and it was only after she passed that he became more verbose and wanted to tell stories and talk about who he was and where he'd been and share with other people and be in fellowship, really, with other men's groups like that. So I just thought it was really interesting. So that's my theory, is that Bob's value and what really happened there was the encouragement to listen to Bob because he had such tremendous worth.
That's cool. Is Becky here?
No, she couldn't.
Oh, his niece was going to come tonight, but she couldn't make it. And then last Thursday, they taped a picture of him to the booth and texted, remembered with honor and love this morning at Denny's, of Bob. I think that's what it means to honor the elderly, because they have so much to give. So we'd like to wrap up our time, at least with this section. We'd like to hear Bob's going to sing Amazing Grace. Stay here, you guys. Just stay here for a second. You guys, let me just wrap this up. I think this is what we're trying to say here this morning, is this, probably, what do we do with this all? What do we do with it? First of all, let's affirm the Imago Dei, the image of God in each and every person. Every person. Secondly, let's find value. Let's find and value the wisdom that those who have run the course ahead of us. And that's what these guys did. They found incredible wisdom and value in knowing Bob. Third, I think we as a people have to appreciate the challenges of getting older. It's hard. It's not for sissies. Let's appreciate that. And last but not least, let's honor the elderly face to face with sincerity, humility, kindness, and respect. Okay? Now, I think maybe it starts, as these guys talked about, and as Bob would always talk about, it starts with acknowledging and celebrating the creator and the sustainer and the redeemer of life, and that was Jesus. And so we're going to come and celebrate Christ for the value that life brings, and today we'll do it in a unique way by understanding not only Bob, but all his generation, and thanking God for that, okay? So, band, why don't you come up? And then if you're going to serve communion, why don't you take your spots? And let's come and celebrate what Christ has done for us. Thanks, guys. Let me pray for us as we enter into this. Father, we recognize the reality that you created life. You created it and you sustain it. And you have a value to it no matter what. And thank you for Bob, 95, almost 96. Thank you for him, and thank you for every person that he represents. Father, forgive us that we have not valued that generation. Forgive us as a nation, as a people, as a church, forgive me. But Father, we want to celebrate what you have done, who you are, in the fact that just like Bob, he found amazing grace in you. And so we come here to celebrate your amazing grace in our lives. And we do this with each other, and we do this in kind of connection with Bob in this. So we come to celebrate the fact that you gave your body, sacrificed for us, your blood that would cover our sin. And we come to say thank you and to remember and to celebrate. And we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.